Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Issues in 30 days, issues 11 through 15, development in New Jersey. We did five parts last week on development as an issue in the New York City mayoral race. This week it's development and the New Jersey governor's race. And we have our New Jersey Development Wiki up at WNYC.org for you to help produce this series like Wikipedia. This is Wiki election coverage. So click on Brian Lehrer Show and keep suggesting guests and questions and audio clips for this week. This is a group process, collaborative between you and us. And in a few minutes, we'll meet a guest from Jersey City who one of you did suggest through the Wiki at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We begin the series with an uncomfortable truth. Development and corruption are intimately linked. The big corruption sweep in July that netted 44 suspects, well, the FBI informant posed as a developer and went from city to city in New Jersey offering bribes. Now, a developer offering bribes was apparently seen as normal, not an aberration. Otherwise, the informant would have posed as something else. And that's not to say that most developers are corrupt. It is to say that a lot of corruption apparently leads to development. And on that cheery note, let's bring in our first guest, Bridget Harrison, political science professor at Montclair State. Professor Harrison, thanks for coming on WNYC.
My pleasure, Brian.
Did it surprise you this summer that the sting involved an informant posing as a developer?
Well, I think that it was surprising only in the sense that we haven't seen an enormous level of law enforcement targeting that side of the corruption development issue. We've seen, you know, maybe a few developers prosecuted, but we don't see elected officials being gone after by what was purportedly a developer. This is an indication, as you said, that this is really where corruption is occurring in the state.
He allegedly roped in the mayors of Hoboken and Ridgefield and Secaucus, various officials in New Jersey. We'll take a close look at in Jersey City, which we will take a close look at with our next guest, an assemblyman from Ocean County, among others. So various localities, public officials everywhere seemed open to these $5,000 bribes that he was offering. What would the more traditional corruption investigation have been involved if not development?
Well, what we see on the public end of it is we see lots of focus on corruption by elected officials who are, you know, raiding the state budget, whether it's Wayne Bryan in the southern end of the state who referred to the state budget as kind of an ATM machine where he could essentially get what money he needed personally out of the state budget. But I think that your point about the small amount that was required, you know, a $5,000 or a $3,000 bribe, is really an indication of the systemic level of corruption when it comes to development. Most elected officials aren't going to be willing to sell their souls or, you know, end their political careers for a mere $3,000 or $5,000. What that's an indication of is that this is a way of life, that they can count on this as a revenue source. And so, therefore, some developers are making these payments, these bribes. And what we haven't seen, because, of course, there are some serious political consequences to going after developers, namely that you create a chilly climate for development in the state, what we haven't seen is law enforcement going after that side of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some ways that you can parallel it to prostitution. Part of the problem is supply, and the other part of it is demand. And we haven't seen developers, or the Johns in this case, target it.
And we'll get to demand in a minute. But how much of an impact do you think corruption born of developer-politician relationships has actually shaped what New Jersey is today? The first comment on our webpage on this says, driving through places like Middlesex, Bound Brook, Warren, Watchung, and the Plainfields, one realizes that corruption, combined with felonious incompetence, has entirely reshaped the current-day landscapes and topographies of these places. So how much do you think that's true?
I would agree with that comment, and I think that it is difficult to measure because most of it occurs at the municipal level. We have very strong home rule. We have very strong municipal charters that enable municipalities or elected officials in municipalities to be the channels, the wherewithals that can target, you know, development that can enable, whether it's things like tax abatements or planning or zoning code changes or even more complicated scenarios like eminent domain, that rests nearly universally entirely in the hands of the municipality unless state funds are used.
New Jersey listeners, anything you want to say about the relationship between development and corruption in New Jersey, its impact, and how it may be an issue for you in the governor's race? Do you think Corzine or Christie or Daggett or any of the other even smaller party candidates are best positioned to deal with corruption as an issue in New Jersey development? We know it's a corruption-obsessed state. We know it's a development-obsessed state. People don't always make the link between the two, but that's our issue for today in our 30 Issues in 30 Days election series. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And there is a very good backgrounder on all of this that our Bob Henley did, WNYC's Bob Henley, and we've posted it on our website. Many of you in New Jersey are going to want to read this. Bob's been covering New Jersey development and corruption for 30 years, and he posted a really thoughtful piece about some of the root causes of this. And as I say, a lot of you New Jersey listeners are going to want to read Bob's piece at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. And for our guest, Bridget Harrison, professor of law and politics at Montclair State, I want to bring in a couple of things that Bob wrote as kind of a theory about root causes of all this. Part one, when the cities lost their manufacturing jobs a few decades ago, cities in New Jersey, as cities all over the Northeast, they had to figure out how to replace their tax base. And housing development and these other kinds of contemporary development were seen as a cash cow for tax revenues. And part two, New Jersey has too many towns and school districts, about 600 of each in a pretty geographically small state. And this massive amount of government leads to a constant push for development because only development will bring in the cash needed to run all those schools and police departments. So how much do you think those things are true?
I think that he's absolutely positively right about both of those things. I think that in addition to the municipalities seeing that decline in manufacturing and wanting to substitute in an expansion of the tax base in terms of development, we also see the emergence of very strong labor unions, particularly within the construction trades, and a relationship between parties, elected officials of both political parties and those labor unions. And so, you know, the AFL-CIO, construction workers, building trades council, all have very close relationships, not only with municipal elected officials, but also statewide elected officials. And this kind of relationship breeds this almost a symbiotic relationship. Development benefits the municipalities. It benefits labor unions, who, of course, want more jobs in their towns. And so a lot of times this kind of corruption occurs with a wink and a nod because everyone seems to benefit. Of course, sometimes what we'll then see is development that isn't necessarily sustainable or isn't necessarily something that is going to be a continuing source of revenue, and we've seen that throughout the state.
So if cities and towns are hungry for development, for tax revenue, and for these reasons that you and Bob are talking about, why would a developer need to offer a bribe?
Well, I think that there's, first off, competition between developers. There's also, developers need things. They need codes changed. They need zoning changed. Oftentimes, they'll need a tax abatement. Sometimes, depending on how developed the municipality is, they may need things like eminent domain. And so lots of times, government officials, in selecting which developer will develop a particular area, but also in providing the kind of package that results in development, that is something that is valuable to developers. The other thing is that this kind of takes on a life of its own. This is the MO. This is how business occurs. And because it is this continuing relationship with elected officials, some old, some new, and developers, they continue operating in the same fashion.
Tom and Metuchen, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. The reason I'm calling, my dad, who passed away now, used to be a real estate developer in Middlesex County. And it was, I remember as a young child, and I'm 56 now, delivering paper bags full of 10s and 20s to local assemblymen and stuff, you know,
kidding.
To get variants. And I mean, it's just standard procedure, especially in Middlesex County, Tioga.
And what did your dad tell you about this?
That's just part of the cost of doing business. You know, you buy a piece of property for $100,000, it's residential. You get the zoning changed to commercial, and that same piece of property just went up $50,000, $60,000 in value.
Think it's different today?
And if it costs you $10,000 for the variance, you know, that you're good to go.
You think it's different? It's an amazing story. And you know, amazing to hear it spoken out loud, really. Do you think it's any different today?
If anything, it's worse. Especially with the economy the way it is. These guys are, I mean, nobody can survive on what they pay assemblymen. They need another source of income.
Tom, thank you very much. Professor Harrison, any reaction to Tom?
Well, I think that perhaps unlike in Tom's dad's day, in my belief, most of this kind of corruption that we see is stemming at the municipal level. And so we're not seeing members of the state legislature necessarily being in cahoots with developers, though, of course, that does occur. But primarily we're seeing, because of our strong home rule charters, we're seeing this occurring at the municipal level. And that raises up that second point with regard to so many layers of government or so many governments. There is not very much state oversight with roughly 1,270 governments. And I think that schools are a little bit unique because schools actually, when they spend state and federal money, do have to undergo a more rigorous auditing system than development that occurs privately or development that is only being supported by municipal funds. But I think that when you have so many local governments, it leads to these fiefdoms in which developers are in a great relationship either with a mayor or a president of city council or a majority of city council, and they support those individuals financially, either both with bribes and with campaign contributions. And what that means then is that relationship continues. They become the strong incumbents. It's almost impossible to get rid of them.
Michelle in Monroe, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hello, I can't agree with you more. I'd like a specific example is we lost 35 acres of beautiful uplands of Green Acres parkland and Middlesex County parkland to essentially developers in the back end. The municipality had to take it because of the rampant development and really unchecked development in our community. We needed a new school, which everyone agreed that we needed, but we had plenty of property in town, but it was eyed by the developers. So we lost beautiful parkland, although it was taken by diversion. What we got instead was the developers' leftovers, landlocked properties that they now say is part of our park, which is not contiguous. And all of the developers bought the alternatives to the school instead of being in the park went to developers. And we even went to the appellate division. But the most egregious thing was Senator Bob Smith, who has, I think he has some oversight over Green Acres and the DEP, comes before our municipality with land developers. And he was instrumental in actually allowing the Green Acres diversion process to take place. It was very disconcerting.
Michelle, do you think at least your property taxes have gone down or not gone up as much as a result of things like this? Because another point that Bob Henley makes in his essay is that municipalities are hungry for developers for the tax revenues, because the theory is that's going to help keep property taxes down, and we know how much of a problem that is in New Jersey.
That has absolutely been the opposite. What happens, and Monroe has about 60% adult communities, which was the promise of keeping property taxes down. Instead, the original referendum for the school was $110 million. Then they said they were going to get free land. They called it actually free land from the parkland. And they said it would be $82 million because we were getting this free land. Well, the cost is now over the original referendum that was defeated, and it is now about $130 million.
Mm. Michelle, thank you very much. Any comment, Professor Harrison, on the Monroe situation in particular, or that general link that's supposed to apply between the so-called ratables from the developers getting tax revenue in and the property tax rates?
Well, I think that what Michelle describes is not uncommon. I mean, Senator Smith's insertion of himself, he is chair of the Senate Environment Committee, is, I think, rather unique. But I often see this competition, as it were, between protected green acres, whether it's pinelands or green acre sites, and developers. And because we are such a densely populated and developed state, and also because much of our green acres are protected through state legislation, we often see this competition. But I also think that when making the kinds of development decisions that many municipalities are making, they're looking at short-term goals, and they're looking at short-term revenue streams rather than sustainable development that might positively impact the tax revenue. I think that most individuals, though of course they want to see green spaces protected, would support development that would actually have some bearing on their property taxes if it meant a revenue stream. But oftentimes we see almost one-shot revenue deals through the creation of industrial parks, for example, that you know, don't have any occupants and therefore aren't really generating any revenue or very much revenue for municipalities. Or in particularly in this economy, we're seeing half development, where developers start a project and then no longer have the financing required to continue. And you know, municipalities are left with this kind of undeveloped mm-hmm. eyesore in the middle of their town. I think that we're seeing that more and more frequently throughout the state.
We're talking about the relationship between development and corruption as an issue in the New Jersey governor's race with Bridget Harrison, professor of law and political science at Montclair State. From our comments page, Danny writes, I lived in Woodbridge when McGreevy was mayor, and the policy de rigueur for all undeveloped patches was, in this major township, trees and lots don't generate tax revenue. Today in Woodbridge, there is hardly a lot that hasn't been developed. And Paul writes on our webpage, I think you are ignoring the role that inner city crime plays in the overdevelopment of rural New Jersey. People are fleeing dangerous schools in once nice towns that were developed in the early 20th century. How true do you think that is, Professor Harrison?
I do think that people are fleeing those towns. That is true. I mean, we see that kind of out-migration, and we do see that as a potential area of development. On the other hand, we also see those gentrified areas in some urban areas, and I know you have Steve Phillip coming on from Jersey City, a kind of perfect example of a town that has been developed in a kind of gentrified way that makes it appealing and attractive to new, particularly young families. And I think that provides an environment in which corruption can become rampant uh-huh. because it is costly and attractive development. And it is very difficult to build opposition domestically within a municipality to that kind of development, particularly when you are refurbishing eyesores or generating revenue in a downtown area.
And we will be speaking to City Councilman from Jersey City, Stephen Fulop, in just a couple of minutes, kind of fashioning himself as a whistleblower on some of this right now in the case of Jersey City. For those of you who are trying to get to the Bob Henley essay on development and corruption in New Jersey, we had it on our blog, which is a little buried on our site. We've now moved it to the main page of the Brian Lehrer Show, so you can go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you'll see it right there. So, Professor Harrison, since we're doing this in the context of the governor's race, I think you've given us a really good backgrounder on the relationship between corruption and development in general. Where does state government come in? I mean, these allegedly corrupt officials arrested in July were in almost all cases at the local level. How much does this belong as an issue in the governor's race?
Well, I think it certainly belongs as an issue. I don't think that we're seeing it emerge in an enormous way in the governor's race. I think that all of the gubernatorial candidates are talking about the issue of corruption in a way that is perhaps not resonating to most New Jerseyans. They're talking about eliminating things like wheeling or dual office holding or dual public employment. Those aren't the kind of things that are changing, as one of the blog posters that you had read mentioned, the topography of our state. That is not changing. And voters have the option of rejecting people who want to engage in dual office holding, for example. Lots of times voters don't have the ability to reject the kind of development, particularly if it's framed in corruption, that they would on other issues. But because of that link between development and jobs and the economy, gubernatorial candidates typically want to shy away from this because they don't want to risk alienating developers. They don't want to risk alienating those important labor unions in this race.
So do Corzine and Christie have different positions on what to do to break the link between corruption and development, as far as you can tell?
As far as I can tell, they have the same position, and that is no position. I mean, I think that they will tell you we're addressing the issue of corruption, we're addressing the issue of ethics in government. But like I say, most of that comes from regulating and transparency when it comes to the use of state funds. And I think that both of them would also say, and probably Chris Daggett as well, that there are enough laws on the books to prosecute those who are engaging in this kind of behavior. It really is a question of the law, the climate of law enforcement, and whether they want to pursue developers rather than just the elected officials that are on the take.
Well, what about Chris Daggett, the independent candidate? He used to run the Department of Environmental Protection, right? And at least one of the assembly members arrested in July was approached specifically to influence DEP to approve development projects. So do you think DEP has been corrupt too?
You know, I don't know. I mean, can I say, oh, yes, DEP is corrupt? I think that there have been enough stories to say that there are relationships between elected officials and the Department of Environmental Protection. Do I have a specific example where I can say, aha, here's corruption?
Right.
But I think it's really a question of the climate in which these decisions are made. And I think that given how this sting was undertaken, there's no question about what that climate looks like.
And if sprawl and other overdevelopment that's bad for New Jersey has been approved over and over again in an environmentally challenged state, it makes me wonder, what are they doing at DEP?
Well, I think that there are many people who would agree with you, who would say that particularly when it comes to the northern end of the state, we don't see the DEP protecting particularly the small green acres that are left here.
And last thing, people would argue that all of this conversation about overdevelopment, anytime we talk about overdevelopment, it's from some kind of elitist perspective. And if people didn't want all that housing there, if people didn't have a demand for all that sprawl, then it wouldn't be built. And so why do any kind of planning to knock it down, since people are wanting these homes, people are moving into these homes?
Well, I think in some ways, I think that's an accurate assessment. I think that if you're the sheetrock layer who's going to be sheetrocking the house, or if you're a person who's able to purchase a middle-income home and you wouldn't have otherwise been, you may have different priorities. But perhaps it is the obligation of the elite to think about green acres, the protection of long-term goals in terms of the environment, in balancing the needs of general society versus the needs of a private individual.
Bridget Harrison, political science and law professor at Montclair State University, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure.
A good kickoff to this series, development in New Jersey as an issue in the governor's race. And we're going to spend a few more minutes on it and dig down a little deeper on the case of Jersey City and the relationship between corruption and development there. Stay with us. Issues in 30 days, issue 11, development and corruption together as an issue in the New Jersey gubernatorial race. And we've been talking about that connection with our first guest. And Jersey City is at the center of it all. Its recent residential and commercial building boom has made it a destination for the hip, upwardly mobile set looking to move out of Manhattan. But the boom's now under a cloud of suspicion because many of the city's elected officials are implicated in the recent corruption allegations. So to understand a little better how the city has changed in the recent past and how development and political corruption may have factored into those changes, we're joined by Jersey City Ward E Councilman Stephen Fulop. He has championed ethics reform in the city since he was elected in 2005 and now has finally passed anti-pay-to-play legislation. He was suggested as a guest by one of our 30 Issues Wiki contributors, and we invite many more of you to contribute during this week of development issue coverage here in the 30 Issues in 30 Days series. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to suggest any guests or angles or sound bites or anything else in this series, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Stephen Fulop, welcome to WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Thanks for having me.
And for calling, for coming on. We called you. But we want people to call us if you live in Jersey City right now for the next few minutes only. Only if you live in Jersey City. We want to hear from you on the link between corruption and development that you think may exist in your city. And also in just kind of in general, do you think the turn that Jersey City has taken in recent years is good for the city? 212-433-WNYC. Did you move from Manhattan or Brooklyn New Jersey? Listeners, did you move from Manhattan or Brooklyn to Jersey City or somewhere else because of the boom there? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And you didn't move there from Manhattan.
No.
You've been holding these rallies on the steps of City Hall calling for ethics reform. But that would indicate that the problem has to do with the current state of the law, not people who are breaking the law.
You know, it's probably on multiple fronts. I would say a year and a half ago, we did via referendum kind of that contractor pay-to-play, which is restricting people who have government contracts from being significant contributors. And then at the same time, we put forward the development pay-to-play, and we lost that one via, I think the vote at that time was 8-1 or 7-2. But the development laws in New Jersey are very, very pro-development. So we didn't have the opportunity to do it via referendum like we did on the contracting side. So, you know, the U.S. attorney could obviously change a lot of people's opinions. And after the 44 arrests, 18 of which happened to be from Jersey City, there was an appetite or pressure that actually moved it forward on the council agenda. So you can't legislate ethics, so to speak, but you could kind of put barriers and obstacles in place that hopefully will meaningfully change the system.
So can you describe briefly for people who don't know Jersey City, the residential development boom?
Yeah, I mean, it's been absolutely tremendous. And the best way to kind of highlight is to say that in the next census, next year, that Jersey City will likely be the largest city in New Jersey, overtaking Newark. So that kind of speaks to the growth. And the majority of that growth has happened in the waterfront. When you look across the river, all those towers that you see have pretty much happened in the last 10 years. And the city's been very aggressive with tax abatements and incentives, all of which have its place for certain, but, you know, they're controversial at time on how the city has been using them.
And who's moving in?
You know, you have a mix. You have a mix of empty nesters. You have a mix of people from Manhattan who, you know, still like kind of that urban feel but want a little bit more room. So you have a whole gamut of different types of people moving in overall. But, you know, a lot of those people haven't really gotten involved in the community per se. So it's not necessarily that they feel like they have significant roots there. So getting involved in the political process, you know, has been a little bit challenging in a lot of those newer towers.
Tracy in Jersey City doesn't like these changes much, I don't think. Hi, Tracy. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Hey, Steve. I'm in your ward, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
When you look at the waterfront, that's all you need to see where Jersey City has gone so wrong, because not very long ago, it was a clean slate. They could have built anything there. They could have built something beautiful and something that people would want to go to. And instead, it's just a wall of skyscrapers blocking the river from the rest of Jersey City. And there's no there, you know, and it just looks like this is a line of skyscrapers whose developers have definitely bought their way in.
Tracy, thank you. So, Steve Fulop, Councilman,
yep.
how much of this wall of skyscrapers do you think would not be there or maybe not be there in their current forms without politicians greasing the wheel for developers or developers greasing the palms of politicians, either in legal or illegal fashion?
I mean, you know, the Jersey City would have probably still moved forward, not at the same rate, obviously. I mean, the best example of kind of this pay-to-play and this culture in New Jersey would be one of the, it's called the Crystal Point. It's one of the larger buildings on the waterfront. And, you know, the Jersey Journal did a great job of covering it over the last month, that the actual day of the caucus that the council was voting, you know, you had significant contributions coming into the mayor's account. So, you know, it's legal, but there's obviously an ethics issue there, a moral issue there. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we were trying to change. So even when you had a lot of the city administration, the long time that aren't political, saying that that particular abatement wasn't in the best long-term interest of the city, it still was approved. And in hindsight, you know, it's probably not so difficult to connect kind of the money to the actual vote. So we're looking to eliminate that. And, you know, one would reasonably think that most of the development would have still moved forward in the real estate boom that we had over the last decade.
Sophie in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sophie.
Thanks for having me. I wanted to actually thank you also for having Steve Fulop on board for today. He's really great, and all of us in Jersey City are really proud of what he's been doing. For me specifically, I've lived in Jersey City for close to 11 years now, and I've seen the downtown area develop immensely. And I'm not necessarily pleased to see what has happened. I mean, a lot of these buildings have been left open without any residents in them because people either can't afford them, people who live in the town even can't afford to move into them. And one of the major problems also is some of these buildings are built to be self-contained so that the residents in them don't even give back to the community. And that's a really big problem for the people, for the businesses there who obviously are you know, depend upon the people who live there. So that's just been a big issue of mine.
Sophie, thank you for your call. And I wonder, you know, all our Jersey City callers right now are kind of like in Sophie's position and Tracy's position. They've been there a while. They don't like all the change. Who are you who are moving into the towers? I know some of you must be listening. Somebody right now is listening in a Jersey City high-rise right across the river from about where we are here in Lower Manhattan. If that is you, we want to hear your perspective on this. Why did you move to Jersey City? Are you glad you moved to Jersey City? Do you think about corruption in Jersey City yourself? Are you dismayed to hear that some of your neighbors don't like you there or don't like your building there? What do you think about the aesthetics of your building? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you live in one of the waterfront complexes in Jersey City yourself, as we talked to Councilman Steve Fulop. And Councilman, since this segment is in the context of the governor's race, I don't even know your party. I'm guessing you're a Democrat.
I am.
So are you going to argue that John Corzine is better situated than Chris Christie to do something about this?
I have actually, you know, on that front in particular, I've been a critic of Governor Corzine. And, you know, my feelings are that after the arrest, that he came out fairly selectively with aggressions as it relates to different political leaders who were arrested. In the case of Jersey City, you cannot win statewide without carrying large numbers in Hudson County, which Jersey City represents almost 50% of. And I felt that he came out very, very soft on some of those people who were indicted or subject to those complaints. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that Governor Corzine has been terrific on it. And, you know, it is what it is at this point. But I happen to be a Democrat, and that's one issue that I'm probably not in line with the governor on.
And our last guest said that neither gubernatorial candidate, nor even Chris Daggett. Daggett will be on later in the week, by the way, in our development series. But that it is basically as big a thing as it is, this link between corruption and development. It's not really broken out as an issue in the governor's race because neither of them want to talk about it because both of them want to continue good relationship with developers who they feel are important to the growth of the state, including balancing the books of the state coffers.
It's true. And I would just say that a lot that happens in New Jersey is the cause of that, I would argue, is that it's a lack of media scrutiny. So we're sandwiched between the New York media market and then the Philadelphia media market, and it takes something drastic to happen where the country kind of focuses on New Jersey's corruption. Example, people selling kidneys, example of the 44 arrests that happened last month. So, you know, this sort of culture, you know, has been at the heart of New Jersey probably for the last 50 years. And so, you know, this is kind of a little blip. And had the economy not gone to where it is, probably a year and a half ago, Christie probably thought that this would be his issue that he could ride on because it's always looming there. But it's been overshadowed, obviously, with other more important personal issues taxes primarily.
Tom in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, I'm on?
You are.
Okay. Hey, Brian, I'm a huge fan. I just wanted to voice my opinion. I'm a consultant that works for some developers down there. I can understand people's viewpoint with the towers and everything. But if you go along the waterfront, there's a lot of housing. There's a lot of public access to parks. They're building a path. I believe it's from Liberty State Park up through Hoboken. That's almost completed. That whole area, because of my field, I know for a fact was heavily, heavily contaminated, and they've cleaned up a lot of it. So that's it. I mean, I just wanted to give my opinion that, these developers aren't, the boogeymen that you're making them out to be.
And Councilman Phillip, do you want to react to Tom?
Yeah, that waterfront walkway is actually open. It opened last month. Corzine was actually a part of that, as was the Lefrak family, which is a huge developer in Jersey City. So the Lefraks actually came in 25-plus years ago, and when they came in, they were pioneers. And I think that part of the sentiment that you hear with your callers is that it's really changed, whereas, some of the incentives are no longer necessary. Now, granted, when they came in 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 15 years ago, they were necessary, but it's kind of changed. So a lot of people would feel that it's kind of a tale of two cities, where you have these glass towers on the waterfront, and then there's the rest of the city, which hasn't necessarily seen the benefits of all the development there. So that's kind of where a little bit of the tension is from.
Tom, thank you very much. And as I said at the beginning of the hour, none of this is to say that most developers are corrupt. It just is to say that a lot of corruption seems to lead to development. We're almost out of time, but I just want to throw in one other thing real quick. Paul Goldberger, the architecture critic for The New Yorker, described the waterfront development in Jersey City as, quote, an incoherent splattering of buildings. He said that it ought to feel more like a real city, but instead we have a place with no center other than a suburban mall. Do you see what is now the largest city in the state that way?
No. I think that, we certainly have some of that. I think that's a little bit of a harsh assessment of what's happened in Jersey City. I just want to go back to one point on the developer corruption issue. When we put forward that pay-to-play initiative, it's important to point out that most of them actually were very supportive of it because, they're doing business properly and they don't want to feel obligations that they have to give to those elected officials because they're making the asks and they feel that the circle works that way. So, per your point, not all developers are corrupt. You obviously have your bad apples there, but, a lot of them did support a good government initiative when we moved it forward.
Jersey City Councilman Steve Phillip supporting a pay-to-play initiative to break the link between developers and politicians in his city, which he says is going to come out as maybe shockingly to some, the biggest city in the state when the 2010 census is done, surpassing Newark in population for the first time. Councilman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
30 issues in 30 days. Issue 11 ends here, but all this week we will be focusing on development as an issue in the New Jersey governor's race tomorrow. Xanadu and the Meadowlands. And coming up in a minute, the art and strategy of the compliment.